This is Linda Leonard, The Call to Create, May 12, 2000.
Talk about the call to create, and then I'm going to talk about the phases of creativity that I see, that just briefly. And then I'm going to talk about inner characters in the that I see in the creative process and in creative life. And then I'll probably end with a few fairy tales. So, as far as the call goes, I think that we're all called to create. Jung certainly thought that. You remember that, and also I should say that artists and poets from many, you know, ancient times, including Socrates and Rilke and Yeats, all talk about the call that they felt to create. So that call, I think, is the central call in some ways of the human condition. I think it's a call to live creatively and spiritually and into wholeness. And so recognizing the call is really essential to creativity. And some people think that they're not creative. I've heard a lot of people say that, I'm not creative. And I think that that's because they're viewing creativity in a very limited way and in a way that's kind of been structured by the patriarchal culture, a rational, linear view of creativity. Whereas somebody like Jung and many, you know, artists and so forth, they're seeing the call in a much broader sense. So, for example, Maya Angelou, she talks about the call, and she sees it as a call that everyone shares, and she understands it as being present wherever she is, to whatever she's doing, and to whomever she's with. And she sees that as a responsibility to be present. So being present for her is responding to the call. And she says, it doesn't matter if I'm stirring a pot of beans, patting a baby's head, or writing my book. It's all, that's all dwelling poetically, is the way she puts it. Rilke, I'd like to share this story about Rilke. Some of you I know are familiar with it. But Rilke talked a lot about the call. And he said that, you know, all of his life he felt a call. And then, of course, he started writing poems and he started writing letters and publishing pretty early. And he'd really written hundreds of poems and hundreds of letters. But he felt that within that process of writing that he still had a call to write something. Something that he didn't know what it was, but he would know when he found it. Okay? So when he was about, I think, probably about late 30s or maybe around 40, Rilke was quite unusual because he had a very interesting penchant for attracting ladies who owned castles in Europe. And all of these ladies all over Europe would lend him their castle. Now, he stayed there alone always, but they would exchange letters. And so at one of these castles, when he was about 40, something like that, this castle was called the Duino Castle, and it was about 30 miles above Yugoslavia, above Trieste, on the Adriatic Sea. And he was there, and he couldn't, you know, it wasn't coming. And then he was walking, as he usually did, around the cliffs. This was high up. And a storm broke out, and a great wind came. And into his head came the first lines of the Duino elegies. Who, if I called, would hear me among the angelic orders? And then he ends that line with, for beauty is nothing but beginning of terror, we're still just hardly able to bear. So that was the first line, blown kind of almost through him by the wind, a force of nature, of course. And then he sat down and he wrote the rest of that elegy. Of course, he didn't just sit down and write an elegy. He'd been working for, 20, 30 years on the art and craft and toil of writing poems, okay? So it wasn't like, it just came. He channeled it simply. He'd been working to craft what he was going to receive. And he got the entire elegy. He knew first elegy. He knew that was what he was to get. And then, but then the rest didn't come. And he had to wait. And in fact, all in all, he had to wait 10 years. Bits of the elegies would come, or maybe in one case another single elegy came. But he just had bits and pieces, and he knew he wasn't through. And then 10 years later, at another castle, a more modest castle this time, in the French part of Switzerland, in the Rhone Valley, at Rhone, where he's buried now, quite near there, he was walking again, not quite so high up this time, and somehow the rest of the elegies started coming. And so he wrote them down. Took him, a while to complete. And then a few days later, he received spontaneously, without expecting anything, because when he finished the doing elegies, he knew that was what he was meant to do. He received an additional gift of about 25, 30 sonnets, the sonnets to Orpheus, who, as you know, Orpheus is the legendary poet who travels between the two worlds, the underworld, or what we might call as Jungians the unconscious, and the human world. So that was Rilke's experience with the call. Now, his is a really dramatic experience, and most of us don't have that dramatic experience, but I think it's good to hear a dramatic experience so that you get a sense of the elements of it, the waiting that you have to do, the patience that you have to have to listen and to be ready and to prepare yourself, the craft and everything, and then finally to receive it. These are all different aspects that are involved in the creative process. So that's the call, and then the next part is responding to the call. So you kind of have to identify the call in some sense, know there's a call, and then it takes responding to the call. And I just like to briefly mention, I see five phases of creativity. There's inspiration, of course, and that can come in any of the other phases. And there's the surrender phase, where you in order to go into the unknown, you have to be free of what you've known. And to do that, you really have to make a surrender. So there's the surrender phase, and that usually entails being in a dark period, a dark night, because you don't know what you're going into, and the unknown is dark. And as we know, St. John of the Cross expresses that period through his poem, Dark Night of the Soul. And there's a process there where you kind of have to wait and try to witness what's going on and be patient, but also be ready to receive the new vision. And then there's what I call the work and toil and struggle phase, where you have to really work and toil and struggle to hone your craft, whether it's an art form or whether it's your life. And I think there's also a phase, and these are not linear phases as I see them. They're more cyclical phases. There's a phase of rest and regeneration, where you have to give, the psyche needs a rest and the body needs a rest. And without that rest, you probably eventually get kind of caught into maybe a perfectionistic, an obsessive cycle that could pull you downward. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then finally, I see the phase of giving and embodiment and sharing. Okay, so there are four kind of cyclical phases, and inspiration, as I see it, can come up at any one of those phases. Just as a little structure that I see in the psyche, Jung saw the energy of the psyche as daimonic. In the etymology of the word, and in ancient times, the daimon was an energy that could be pulled to the divine or the diabolical. So, as human beings, there's the challenge that we all have to, one, acknowledge that tension, and two, to try to direct it towards wholeness or towards the good. But it's possible if the ego gets out of control and becomes possessed and monomaniacal, it's possible to get drawn to the diabolical. So you can see this with Hitler, of course. Rollo May talks a lot about this in Love and Will, and I talk about it in my book Witness to the Fire, which is on addiction and creativity. And then there's the other, a third way to relate to this creative energy, the daimon, and that is to deny it and repress it or suppress it. So that would be then somebody who's trying to keep it away, and that's usually somebody who's like totally maybe identified with the collective, or one of the characters that I have in my book. I have a bunch of characters that are kind of dancing around here. Is called the I call the conformist, a character that I see in everybody, really. The conformist is likely to try to dodge that tension, because the conformist wants security and status, tries to keep the status quo. And then when that happens, the person who's resisted looking at the tension, the creative tension that can go either way to the divine or diabolical, tends to get pulled unconsciously into the diabolical, as with, you know, the in the time of Hitler, the German people who were pulled with him, not all of them, but the ones who were pulled with him. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's kind of the way I see the creative process working. And I have then kind of, so I see the theater, I call it the theater of creativity. I see the theater of creativity as having many characters, but I see the backdrop for it and the stage as nature. Because I think the nature herself, with the cycle of seasons and many different processes that we have, has the same kind of cycles and rhythms that we do in our own in ourselves, because we are part of nature. Okay, so in the book, from time to time, what I'm doing is I'm using images from nature that kind of help you. It gives some maybe physical experience you've had. You know, let's say you were out and on a hike, and a lightning storm struck. And that's very frightening, you know, to have that lightning storm. But if a lightning bolt comes near you and you survive it, the shock may shock you into really paying attention and being thankful for your life. So it's the same way in the creative process. I think we get shocked, so to speak. And I see that happening through anxiety, actually. And I make a distinction between fear and anxiety. Fear being, and this is actually Heidegger's distinction, but I see it as operating in psychology and in the creative process itself. Fear being something which has an object, and the object can be removed. And anxiety as a kind of, and I'm not talking now about clinical anxiety, but human anxiety, as something that, a mood that kind of overwhelms us and kind of knocks us kind of off-center in such a way that we're kind of open to the mystery of creation. Okay? Can you connect with this? And lots of people feel that, I think anxiety is an obstacle for lots of people. And but most creative people talk about anxiety as part of their creative process. I certainly experience it. I experience it more actually through lecturing than I do through writing. Although it can come up more with writing, and I certainly experience it in living. So really the anxiety is kind of a creative energy if you can get through the initial onslaught. Okay? So what I want to do before I go into the characters is I'd like to just mention some obstacles, okay, that I see to creativity. Because one of the things I'm doing in this book is I'm trying to ground kind of the creative process in nature and in human nature being a part of that. And then I'm looking at that energy and the importance of standing in the tension of the creative energy and directing it as much as one can towards the good and the struggle that just exists by being in that tension. Jung would call that the tension of the opposites. I mean, it's another way to look, another way to express it, and then I'm trying to look at inner characters in ourselves, for example, I'm thinking of Hermann Hesse and Steppenwolf. You remember how many people remember Steppenwolf? Okay, he was pretty popular. Back in the 60s, and I guess maybe the 70s, huh? Yeah. So you remember that Steppenwolf was a guy, he felt like he didn't belong to the bourgeois or the conformist world, and he felt, you know, that he was different and, you know, artistic in some way, and there's kind of a... But he was torn in two by this, because although he didn't want to belong to the bourgeois world, part of him wanted to have that comfort. And there's a scene where he's sitting on a staircase of his landlady's house and he's listening to them, you know, having their, I guess their small talk with the comfort and security that they have, and wishing he could be part of that actually, even though he disdains it. So he's kind of split into two. And you probably remember in the novel that it's set in Zurich. How many people have been to Zurich? A fair number, actually. Yeah, so those of you who have been will probably remember. And for those of you who haven't, Zurich has a wonderful old town. And that old town, it's on a hill. It's on hills. And it has a lot of different little streets and corners and little gosses and alleys and, you know, just places that you might stumble into one time and that are hard to find another time. So one day, as the Steppenwolf is walking through the old town, I guess it's at night actually, he suddenly sees these neon lights, and it says the Magic Theater, for madmen only, enter at your own risk. Do you remember that? And then I think he loses it. You know, he looks, it grabs his attention, he goes on, and then he tries to find it. And you know how that is when you've seen something and, you know, and but you walk by it and then you try to find it, you know, and suddenly doesn't seem to be there anymore. It's kind of like a dream in a way, you know, if you wake up from a dream and you've got it but you don't remember to write it down or whatever, and you go back, you don't find it. But then sometime later, it might pop up again. So, that happened to Steppenwolf. And when Steppenwolf finally found the Magic Theater and entered it, what he learned is that he had 1,000 or more than 1,000 personalities. And there they were all dancing in costume and with masks. And so he had to learn that he wasn't just two, didn't have two characters in sharp opposition, but he had many, many characters, and they could play or be in a play in different kinds of plots and with many different characters and in different kinds of relations, okay? So that's my image for the characters in this book. But before I get into the characters, I'd like to go back to the obstacles. So I just jotted down a few that I have. Well, I mentioned I'm not creative, that one. That's a lot of people. How many people here have that one? I guess I should. Is anybody brave enough? I bet a lot more have it. Anyway, because I think that's a big one. And, you know, when creativity's cut off, you know, when you feel, when you compare yourself, well, I can give you an example. As a writer, you know, I would like to be a novelist. But if I'm a novelist, I want to be as good as Dostoevsky. Right? That's my comparison. So with that idea in mind, I could say I'm not creative and then not do anything. Right? Okay. So that exists for lots of people in a lot of different ways. Then there's having trouble getting started. I think that's an obstacle for lots of people. You know, how do you get started? And can I get started? And why can't I get started? Then there's the obstacle of fear and anxiety, which I talked about before, and I'll probably come back to again. And the anxiety, by the way, fits into the surrender stage, because I think what the anxiety does is it forces us, if we let it be, to respond and surrender by surrendering, to let go, right? To let go of what we were holding on to. And then by letting go, it's kind of a scary drop into the abyss, but if you can hang there with it in that surrender phase, then you can eventually come out with a new vision. But you have to do a lot of work to do that. And then other obstacles, hurt by criticism and or rejection. So I think that's big for everybody, really, certainly is for me. And I'd just like to share with you that with The Wounded Woman, which was my first book, that I was rejected 42 times. I sent it. In those days, there were more publishers. Now there are three huge mega companies, I guess. I don't know what to call them, and just a few little ones. But in those days, there were a lot more publishers, and I sent it around to 42, and anyway, I got probably more than 42, but I got 42 responses. So that was tough, and it led to one of my characters that I mention in here, the cynic. So I had to deal a lot with the cynic to get through that period. Then feeling like a fraud, I think, is a big one. I think it's particularly a big one for women. It's probably also a big one for men, maybe. I don't know. But, for example, I think I like to sit. And I like to sit for a number of reasons, actually. It's more comfortable. I can be in a more feminine mode, more receptive mode. It's not hierarchical. And I can do more storytelling. It feels natural. Yet the expectation is often that one should stand behind a podium. And but there's something that feels, to me, inauthentic about that, okay? So if I'm standing behind the podium, well, that's interesting. Anyway, the podium, if I were to do that, I wouldn't be feeling like I was myself. Yet that's an expectation, okay? And that's coming pretty much, I think, from a hierarchical model, a linear kind of hierarchical model. So I'm then cut off in that mode from being my more authentic self. Now, for some people, that's fine to stand behind the podium. You know, that's great. I'm just using this as an example. But for me, I don't like it, and nor do I like having to dress in business suits, you know, which they tell you to do, you know, if you're going to make a public, or they, especially on a TV thing. So these are all kinds of things. I think I know a lot of women, and they're very successful women, who share this kind of feeling of inauthenticity if they do it, and then but if they don't do it, then there's something wrong with them. When really, I think what they're seeing is a fraudulence in the whole setup. Do you follow me? Yeah, okay, so I'll just throw that out. How many people have had that experience? Okay. Okay. I think the perfectionist and the rational critic is in that. And Jung had experience with the fraud, which I'll talk about later if I have time. Some of you probably will remember it or already remember it. So some more obstacles. Impatience. Afraid to risk. Have to risk to enter the unknown. And when you're in the unknown, you have to have patience to be there for a while, maybe for a long while. Another obstacle, feeling dry and empty. Can I do anything? Or can I do another project if I've already done one? You know, can I be better than myself? You know, that's one that comes up a lot. Can I top myself? All of that's kind of, again, tied in with the perfectionist. Then there's exhaustion, when you just feel so exhausted by, you know, things in your life and some people feel they shouldn't take the rest, you know, to recoup. So that can be an obstacle. The inability to finish something and put it out in the world is an obstacle. Some people can't finish something, and I'll talk about that later with the characters. Some people finish it, but they don't put it out in the world. So putting it out in the world is part of that giving, embodiment, sharing stage that I see. Okay? Then there's feeling too weak to create, not feeling that one doesn't have the courage, you know, to be themselves. That mean, now I'm talking about, you know, our individuation process. And of course the word for courage comes from the French word cœur for heart. So really what we're talking here about is finding heart. And I think it's essential in the creative process and in the transformation process to find one's own heart and one's own heartbeat, so to speak. Then many people feel overwhelmed, you know, when they're maybe about to begin something, or sometimes when they're in it, it's just like so much stuff and where do I start and I don't know how, you know. So like Psyche, you know, in her first task, she feels overwhelmed with sorting the seeds. That's an obstacle. Feeling lost is an obstacle. Fear of success can be an obstacle, and fear of failure can be an obstacle, and both. And then there's forgetting or neglecting to protect the tender time in creativity. Okay, because, you know, in the creative process, in the beginning, things are very tender. And I may come back to this with an analogy from reindeer antlers. That's an image from nature, and I think the antler growth is very much like the creative process, actually. I'll come back to that later if I have time. But I think this is really important, this necessity to protect the tender time and creativity. And anybody who's in the individuation process knows, you know, that sometimes, if you're in a very deep process, it's not a good idea to share, you know, let's say you're in therapy, what's going on, you know, with too many people, it dilutes the process. And also one has to be, to know who to share with and when, and to honor the tender time and just allow it to mature naturally instead of pushing it ahead. So those are just some of the obstacles that I see. I'm sure there are a lot more that you may want to bring up later when I'm finished. Now for the characters. For some reason in this book, the characters came up in pairs, kind of as hinderers and helpers. But not all the characters, but the first character and the last character are not in pairs, but the others came up in pairs. And as we all know, hinderers have, you know, their other side, right? So they can be of help, but you have to know about them for them to be of help. And similarly, helpers sometimes, if they go to excess, can be hinderers. Right? So you have to know how to direct them. Okay. So I'm just going to mention the characters, and then I'm going to just talk a little bit about them. And I think the way you like to do it here is that I kind of maybe talk for an hour and 15 minutes or something like that, and then I take a break, or you take a break. And I take a break. And then you come back and have questions and answers, is that? I think that's what Lucretia told me. So that means that somebody has to kind of let me know how the time is going. Okay? You're going to let me know. Okay. Good. Okay, so the first character that came to me immediately, when I was in the process of writing this book, is the muse of nature. Okay, now I'll come back to that. I'm just going to name them right now. Then a pair, the sower, the helper, the cynic, the hinderer. I'm just going to name them, and then I'll go over them, okay? The witness, the helper, the tyrant slash victim, the hinderer. Then the sentinel, the helper, and the hinderer, the escape artist. Okay, and I have a bunch of those. Then the helper, the adventurer, and the hinderer, the conformist. Okay. Remember, though, that, as I said, that they're not all totally one, okay? Then the artisan, the helper, and the star, the hinderer. The star. Uh-huh. Then the dumbling, I see as a helper, and the perfectionist as a hinderer. And then the lover, I see as a helper, and the critic, the unhealthy critic, because I make that distinction with the critic, the hinderer. And then finally, the last figure I see as the celebrant, the one who, out of this whole process, learns to celebrate life. Okay, and that. So now I'll go into them. So the muse of nature. I think the muse of nature invites us into an I-thou relationship with nature and with the creative process and the cycles of creativity. And in the in Greek legend, the muses were actually nature spirits. They were daughters of Zeus and the goddess of memory. But further back, they were the daughters of Mother Earth and air. Okay, so they're very nature connected. And at one time, they were also called mountain goddesses. They dwelt on mountains, but in the waters and the woodlands. Okay, so they were born on Mount Olympus, actually. And they presided over the natural mountain springs. And one spring in particular was their favorite spring, and it was created when a horse named Pegasus struck his hoof on a rock. Okay, and then the spring came into being, and that was where the nine muses, because there are nine of them, liked to play the most. And even Athena used to come there to consult with the muses. Athena, you remember, is the goddess of arts and crafts and wisdom, among other things. So they liked to play a lot, and they were known to inspire and enthrall the royalty and also the common people. And they did this by telling and relieved the despair, particularly of the common people. And they did this by telling stories, because their mother, the goddess of memory, she came into being because it was important to remember the stories of humans, both their victories and their defeats, right, in order to be able to learn from them. So she had this art of telling stories and remembering them in that way, and she passed that on to her nine daughters. And did that. They told and retold these stories, ordeals of heroes and heroines, and how they dealt with them or how they didn't deal with them and so forth. But they did it also often through various of the art forms. So each of the muses has a particular art form. And the muses would do this often in a way. They would sing, and they were said to sing so beautifully in harmony that even the birds were in awe of them. So the muses were really connected with nature. And actually Orpheus, you know, who travels between the two worlds, the legendary poet, he was the son of one of the muses. And Apollo gave him a lyre when he was a little boy, and the muses taught Orpheus how to play the lyre. And then, when you remember the story of Orpheus going into the underworld to rescue Eurydice, and he wasn't supposed to look back at her, but just to guide her out, and she called out, and then at the last moment he looked back, and she couldn't come with him, then she had to be returned. And he went forward, and in Greek myth, the story goes on that the Maenads, that devotees of Dionysus, the mad women, they got really angry at Orpheus for abandoning Eurydice, and so they tore him into pieces. But the muses, who loved Orpheus, because of course he was the son of one of the muses and they'd all taught him, they rescued his head and took it to the Isle of Lesbos, where it's said that it continues to sing today. Okay, so you can see all these connections of the muses and creativity. And I think that in our lives, and certainly in the creative process, one feels, you know, one is always hoping the muse will come to one, but one has to be ready to receive the muse. And one often feels lost if the muse doesn't come. Lost and abandoned. But sometimes that phase happens in order to get the person even readier to hear the muse. And so I don't know if any of you remember the story of Green Mansions by W.H. Hudson, the novelist and the naturalist. It's a story about a writer who gets cynical and tired of like city life, and he goes to Venezuela to be in the land, and he's in the jungles, and he hears the sound. Well, he hears a lot of birds, actually, but he hears this particular bird sound that's just really mysterious, and he absolutely has to follow this bird call. And he gets further and further and further and further into the jungle, and he has to push through all this, jungle, dense thickets, bushes, all of this stuff. He has to go across a lot of rivers and bogs and everything. And one day he gets close enough to see the singer, the bird, and it turns out to be a bird girl named Rima. Remember Audrey Hepburn was in the film? Yeah. And Rima becomes his muse, and she speaks in the language of birds. And but then she's a threat to the natives, the regular people who live there, because she's different. And so in the novel, I don't remember how the movie worked out, but in the novel, they get so scared of her that they kill her. And he's devastated, but he says, well, at least I've experienced the muse, and she remains in my memory. So that's, I think, what can happen, that the muse, because of people's fear, so the tyrant, let's say, and the conformist, who I'll come back to that combination, can try to kill off the muse. So, okay. Then I just want to point out the mistake of identifying as muse, the muse speaks through all of us, actually. But sometimes some people will project their own creativity on others, and they'll often project it on a muse, or they'll project it on a muse that can be male and female, or female, either. And sometimes it's even a pet, actually. And but they leave the projection there, right? So they feel they have to have that object, that person as a muse object, so to speak. And sometimes the people who let themselves be these muses, they get a lot of adoration this way, become then kind of reduced to being an object, okay, for other people. So they're in history, for example, Alma Mahler, who I talk about this, her in the Mad Woman book, if you've read the Mad Woman book, but she was a great muse. She had attracted people all over Europe, geniuses primarily, and she grew up. Her father was the Austrian landscape painter, a very famous painter, and she was her father's daughter, and she spent a lot of time with him. They actually lived in a house on the edge of the Vienna woods that you can see from the outside today, and it had an onion turret, and it was, very kind of, and she was kind of like a princess, But then her father died when she was 12, and that was a great tragedy for her. And her mother was a very positive figure, actually. Her mother remarried, and they'd had salons, creative salons, when her father was alive. And then when her mother remarried, she remarried an art dealer, and her mother continued this, giving these creative salons. And Alma started going to them, of course, and now she was, 17, 18, 19, 20, and she was very beautiful. And she had a kind of a charming way of looking at a person as if they were the only person in the world. And part of that, however, had to do with the fact that she was hard of hearing. But the person who was being looked at, they were the only one in the world. And usually that person happened to be a man. So anyway, all these men from all over fell in love with her, and including, when she was 20, Gustav Mahler, the composer. And he came, and he fell in love with her. He was 20 years her senior, and he gave her a letter of proposal for marriage. And then in the letter he offered her, he wanted her to marry him, but he said there can only be one composer in this family. So at that point, she acquiesced. And then she started living her life around him. And in her diary, she would write down her thoughts. She got depressed. She'd write down her her feelings of resentment and stuff, and her feelings of depression. In those days when people were severely depressed, they were sent to a spa, you know, like Marienbad, or the spa at Marienbad in Czechoslovakia, you know, a European spa, to recover. And at one of those spas, she met Walter Gropius, who was a young architect, and somehow came home with the impression that Alma was Mahler's daughter. So he wrote to Mahler and asked for a hand in marriage. Now, Mahler got really disturbed, needless to say. He didn't know what to do. So he called up Sigmund Freud for 1 hour of analysis. And they had their hour, and they did it as a walking hour of analysis. And Freud told him, well, you know, you and Alma are really suited for you. You know she lost her father, and she's looking for a father, and Alma's actually somewhat like your mother. She lives around you, for you, and she's sickly like your mother, too, actually. But then he said, however, there's one thing I do suggest, and that is that you urge her to start composing, because she was composing songs, classical songs. So Mahler took Freud seriously, and he tried to encourage her now to start writing songs. But by this time, she was caught into the muse role, and she kind of rigidified there, and she had all this bitterness and resentment, and she refused. And then, as her life went on, when he died, you know, she had all these suitors again, including... And then, as her life went on, when he died, you know, she had all these suitors again, including Kokoschka and just all kinds of people. But she finally married Gropius. And then, however, she at one of the salons, she met Werfel, who won the Nobel Prize for Song of Bird. Right? If a person identifies with the muse. Okay? Whereas the muse of nature... once is free and transcendent and will be owned by no one. Okay. So there's that muse of nature within us that we have to honor, I feel. So, now comes my character pairs of the hinderers and the helpers. And the first pair that came up for me was the sower, the one who plants and sows seeds, and the cynic. So the sower says yes, I'm just describing the characters now, says yes to life, and the cynic says no to life. Why bother? So the cynic will say, you know, when spring starts to come and the flowers bloom, he'll say, well, you know, there'll probably be a late frost, and they'll all be gone. The flowers will all be gone. It'll be a lousy year. That's kind of like what the cynic would do. The cynic is kind of operating out of disillusionment. He's kind of a disillusion, because these characters don't really have gender, in the sense, you know, that we on Earth here have gender. So the cynic will say... will be an idealist and often a romantic who is so idealistic and so romantic in a way that that he or she wants those ideals to be here all the time. And then, of course, they can't be. And so the cynic then becomes disillusioned and falls down into the cellar of their own house, so to speak. And that's where then the resentment and the bitterness start to come in, and the cynic broods about all this and just spirals downward while secretly getting a high off a secret pride off the resentment. Can you follow how that would work? It's sort of like, well, they think this, but I know what's going to happen. And it's going to be bad. The classic example of the cynic in literature is Dostoevsky's Underground Man in Notes from Underground. I talk about the underground a lot, the underground man a lot in my book Witness to the Fire, because it's a big character in addiction, I see, an archetypal character in addiction, as well as in creativity. And the thing with the cynic is that if the cynic now is pulled down into the darkness, but by being pulled down into the darkness, the cynic can experience and learn a lot about the dark side of life and knows certain dark truths and could come out with them, right? But in order to do that, the cynic has to let go of his or her absolute position in the underground and be willing to come out. And the cynic can come out and share, right, what that darkness is all about, and many people do that. I mean, it's part of the process of transformation and individuation. But they can also stay there and just remain there. I think of the film Leaving Las Vegas. That, remember the, how many people saw that film? It's a fabulous film. I mean, it's about a writer. It's actually a true story about a writer who was an alcoholic and decided to drink himself to death, and did do that. But in the film, he meets a woman and he has the chance for love but rejects it. Well, he doesn't exactly reject it. He doesn't reject the love, but he doesn't make the act of life, which would be the sower. And the sower has to do with commitment. So commitment is a big part of the creative process. You can't really, or any transformation process, you need commitment and the thread of commitment following through something for creativity and for transformation. So the sower will be the one who sows the seeds into the ground and has to find good ground and has to know how to sort the seeds in order to know which seeds are going to grow and which aren't, and how they need to be separated, like in the first task of Psyche, instead of all jumbled up in a big heap. So the sower could be a hinderer if the sower didn't sort out the seeds and just threw them all in a hole in the ground or something, you know, there wouldn't be any growth. And sometimes that happens, that the seeds, you know, too many seeds, or they're planted in the wrong ground, or they're planted too closely together, or with the wrong, you know, other kinds of seeds. And so that's an important thing, the sower, that the sower learns how to sow and plant properly, and then how to wait through the winter period, in the interior winter now, and so that things can bloom. Okay, well, because the cynic in the winter, interior winter period, will be saying, why bother? Why wait around? Because look, nothing's growing now. Okay, so can you see how these figures work together? Athol Fugard, the South African playwright, wrote a wonderful play in which the sower is a sower, a cynic, and a young girl who wants to sing. They're the three characters. The play is Valley Song. And the play is really about seeds. And when he comes out to the audience, he walks around and he has seeds in his hand. And he offers the seeds to the audience first, in reality. They're seeds that he cut up from a pumpkin. He lives in South Africa, so he took a pumpkin there and cut them up. And then he brought them with him. Got him through customs, and then he walks around and offers them to the audience, And then there's the play, which are, you know, the seeds that he's giving you, and the kind of this drama of conflict with the girl who's inspired to sing, and the cynic playwright discouraging her, and the sower in this case, however, wanting at this point has become also a conformist and wants to keep her back. So, and then I think also of Antonia's line. Remember the film where Antonia is sowing the seeds? And she sowed the seeds for, remember that she was born in a small town that was very patriarchal and abusive, and her father was an alcoholic and her mother was kind of crazy, and she left, but then her mother is about to die and she comes back. And when her mother dies, she decides to stay, and she comes back with her daughter. And she sows the seeds of a new kind of life and community in that town, which is no longer hierarchical and patriarchal, but which can breed a new line, a new generation, and that's her line. She has, you know, a daughter, a granddaughter, and a great-granddaughter. And it also breeds, but not without struggle and difficulty, and confrontation, a whole new community. So that one of the scenes is all these different kinds of couples making love, for those of you who saw the film. How many people saw that film? Yeah, fair number. It's really fabulous, so worth renting. It's called Antonia's name, Antonia's the woman, line, L-I-N-E. So the point is, the commitment is really the issue here. And the sower has the hope, the trust, the faith, and the commitment to plant the seeds and to continue through the process. The cynic, it tends to be in doubt and despair. Okay, then I'm going to go on to the tyrant. Is this too much for you? Okay. To the tyrant slash victim, which is the hinderer, and the witness, which is the helper. Okay, now the cynic can easily move to become and or align with the tyrant who wants things in terms of power, wants to have the power and the control, and wants, you know, the tyrant wants what it wants. Regardless. And the tyrant operates on fear. So he provokes fear in others. They're the victims. And they're two sides of the same coin, I think. He provokes fear in others and controls and rules through the fear. And so you see, for example, in the movie Red Shoes, do you remember? That's about a ballerina who was had an impresario, and he was kind of like a demon lover figure, and he made her dance and dance. She loved to dance, but then finally he made her dance so much that she danced herself to death, and that can happen. So the tyrant throughout history, you know, on the outer level politically, but it also happens within us. The tyrant operates on fear and usually tries to gain control of the muse. The tyrant wants to own the muse, and if he can't own the muse, then the tyrant tries to use all the power that he can to keep her in his under his power. And so he intimidates other people to help him do that. And, you know, throughout history, Hitler did that. And, you know, so they threatened the artist. Stalin did it. And Stalin in particular threatened the poets. And the poets, at the time of 1917, at the time of the Russian Revolution, there were four very famous poets. There was Boris Pasternak. There was Ossip Mandelstam, there was Marina Tsvetaeva, and Anna Akhmatova. Anna Akhmatova, I wasn't quite saying that right. And so he first Anna Akhmatova, who was in her life herself the muse. Modigliani painted her portrait. She was a muse for the people, and she was a muse for men who then kept abandoning her. So she was kind of like a muse who became a rejected lover in her personal life and wanted to constantly to be the muse, all right, for the lover, and then she was a so-called lover, and then she wanted to be a muse. She was a muse for the people. So her work was, first it was criticized, you know, for being lyrical and old, and then it was for a long time, over pretty much some 40 years, it was banned. It was first criticized, then censored, then banned. And at a certain point, when Stalin was in control, he threatened these four poets, and in fact, all poets, but these four really stood out. So what he did is he ordered them different things for them. He ordered Pasternak to stay in house arrest. Asat Mandelstam refused to do what he said. What time is it? For what?
Till the break.
Okay, well, I'm only up through my the first two characters. I better finish with this story. So to make a long story short, Asat Mandelstam was finally put in the concentration camp and killed, and right before his death, Pasternak didn't stand up for Mandelstam. Marina Tsvetaeva left Russia, only to come back and find that her husband and her daughter had been killed in concentration camps, and then she hung herself, whereas Anna Akhmatova just stayed true to herself, because during this time she realized that her real call was not to be in a relationship. That wasn't the major call. Her call was to bear witness. So that brings the witness along. And the way she did this was she didn't betray herself. At a certain point, she was put under house arrest. So the people, because the people loved her so much, they were kind of afraid for her to die. And so they'd have her come to the window once a day. She was in exile for a while, too. And then when she couldn't write, because if you wrote anything down and you were found with it, you would be killed. What she would do is she'd write on teeny little scraps of paper, and then she and a number of women friends, including the wife of Mandelstam, who was executed, memorized this poetry. And they held it. They held it all together for quite, about 10 or more years, actually. And then the ban was lifted at a certain point, and she was allowed to publish again. And then they had the poem. They had set a number of poems, but particularly Requiem for a Hero, which bore witness to the war. She didn't give in and become a victim, okay, to the tyrant, nor did she become a tyrant, but she became a witness. So what the witness does is the witness has the courage to stay and watch things and hold them in the memory through, you know, witnessing, okay? And there are lots of, there's, what is it called, authentic dance or something? Authentic movement, I think, uses the witness as its... The witness is really important, and it connects back with the muse. The muse is telling the stories to help the people remember, okay? So you can see how that goes. So the witness is remembering and recording. Now, can I do the Sentinel and the Escape Artist? I won't have gone through the figures yet. So I don't know what to do. What should I do?
Break.
I'll do the Sentinel and the Escape Artist. Then we'll take a break. And then you can decide if
you want me to continue, because you can always buy my book, of course, or ask questions and answers, right? Okay. The sentinel is about being conscious, alert, and wakeful. And so the image for me, actually, for the sentinel came up in the, because I never use this word, but it came up when I watched, I've already seen it, the film Lily Marlene, Fassbinder's Lily Marlene. I get a lot of these characters from films and literature, because they're all over the place, really. Anyway, the end of the movie, it's about a muse who's abused, but I'm not going to get into it. In the end, the message is they sing the Watchman on the Rhine. So I thought, oh yeah, right. And that means you've got to really be watchful, awake, conscious. And the sentinel watches at the borders, also the borders of, on the outer level, the borders between countries. On the inner level, the borders between consciousness and unconsciousness. And we have to go back and forth between consciousness and unconsciousness to create and to transform. And the sentinel is quite different than Freud's censor, who would be the similar figure, I guess you could say, in Freudian thought. Because the censor is trying to keep things from coming up, right? It's repressing and suppressing. And whereas the sentinel is seeing the task, really, of growth as going back and forth. And the sentinel keeps track of the ones who go into the unconscious so they can come out again. Does that make sense? The hinderers there are the escape artist. Right, because the escape artist is trying to escape. And the sentinel is one of the figures who can keep track of the escape artist, who might escape through, I have three, the sluggard, who would be escaping through laziness, okay, or inertia, the doer, who would be escaping through overwork and keeping busy, and the dilettante, who would be escaping through by going from one thing to another, kind of maybe pleasures probably. And then I also thought of putting in the worry wart is really connected with the doer, but worry, you worry about things all the time. Well, that's a way to escape from the creative challenge. Okay, so maybe that's a good place to take a break.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.